listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Robin.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Long time no see.
It's been a while. It's been years since we recorded one of these. I don't know.
My life is full of ideas, so I'm happy to talk to you about a wide range of ideas.
We're going to talk about some of them. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. You're Robin Hanson, economist at George Mason, well-known futurist, author of a couple of books. You also are putting out the Overcoming Bias newsletter.
Blog.
Which, for people interested in the problem of racial prejudice, is not about that. It's about more, I guess, cognitive bias, how to think rationally and so on. Is that the idea?
That was an aspirational initial title, but it's just about whatever I'm thinking about.
Yeah, originally.
It was a group blog for a while, actually. It was actually helped to form the rationalist community in that I had a group blog with Eliezer Yudkowsky, who then split off to make Less Wrong, and his current fame of AI risk. He and I debated those issues in that blog. Many years ago, and the blog has a history.
That's actually relevant to what we're going to talk about, because I want to talk about a few things. First of all, you came up with this phrase, the great filter, and some associated ideas that help us think about the question of whether planet Earth, or how likely it is that planet Earth is doomed. And in particular, think about the Fermi paradox, which we'll get into, which raises a question of whether it's good news or bad news for us that we haven't seen any space aliens. At least I haven't seen any space aliens. Have you seen any space aliens, Robin?
Nor water aliens, nor dirt aliens.
No aliens at all.
Right.
Okay. And then all of this has gotten discussed lately, especially, it seems, in the context of artificial intelligence. Is a superintelligence about to arise? What implications would that have for, well, planet Earth and for humans, which are actually two separate questions, as you've emphasized. But you are not, you do not join in Eliezer's kind of sci-fi doomerism where the planet gets... Or at least you don't think the chances are as high as he does that we're headed in the direction of a superintelligence takeover of the planet, right?
Well, in the long run, I think it's pretty inevitable that our descendants will be much smarter than we are and artificial.
Mm.
So that in the long run, that's pretty much guaranteed, I'd say. The only question is, what path do we take to that route? Is there a moment, say, at some point where machines exterminate all non-machines, for example, mm-hmm. I'm much less worried about that scenario. But I do think that in the long run, our artificial, much smarter descendants would basically take over. They would dominate the evolution of the world, technology, management, etc. They would be the main activity where interesting things were happening. Mm-hmm. Much like in the past, we had the transition in our human history from foraging to farming, from farming to industry, even from other primates to humans. Those were transitions when a new variant appeared and had many advantages and came to displace the others through multiple means, including, extermination in some ways, but more often imitation, absorption. And, winning in terms of growth and population.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the concern is, I mean, first of all, you passed over the extermination part pretty casually.
Right.
but also, what would absorption look like? I mean, will the machines at least have the courtesy to stuff us into the gooey pods in the matrix and let us have pleasant hallucinations? There are all those questions, right?
Sure.
Now, go ahead.
I mean, I actually think in the long term, the way to think about this is in terms of descendants. So, any evolved creatures, including organisms and even cultures, have two fundamental attitudes at their disposal that evolution would endow them with. One would be rivalry toward coexisting competitors who have different genes. And the other is indulgence and help toward descendants who eventually would have different genes, but you just have very different attitudes to those things, right? So a lot depends on whether you frame AI as a coexisting rival or as a descendant. And the key fact is they don't exist yet in a meaningful way. So they can't be coexisting rivals. And when they do exist, they won't come from some other star system and invade us. They will be arising from us. Right. We will cause them to exist. Their features will be, in great detail, modeled after and inherited from us. So in the long run, AI are our descendants. And I think that says the appropriate attitude is a degree of indulgence that you might have thought you would have toward your ordinary squishy bio descendants. That is, most people assume...
I have no indulgence toward mine, by the way, but people differ on this.
Okay, right.
Go ahead.
But the widest attitude among most people is that we expect our squishy bio descendants to be more capable than us, eventually to have more power than us, and to diverge from us in values. And then if there are conflicts, they win those conflicts. That's just most people accept and expect about the squishy bio descendants.
But see, the great thing about children, the great thing about children is that evolution built into them, I mean, offspring, the intuition that they have a non-zero-sum relationship with their parents, even if there's this can be strong zero-sum dynamics that lead to tension. And in fact, at the genetic level, there is a non-zero-sum relationship. And that's the reason this is built into their psychology. Now, I agree that we should try to convince if there's a superintelligence, try to convince it that we are in a non-zero-sum relationship with it. And if possible, set things up so that that's true. And it's as dependent on us as we are on it. But the main reason
we are indulgent to our children is not because maybe we could set up a household with them and cooperate.
Right.
It's because they share our genes, right? Evolution mainly induces us to indulge our children because that's how evolution gets genes to be passed on. It's not because we can just work cooperatively with them.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean. I mean, natural selection, because of the fact that our relationship, your relationship to genes and your kin is not, at the genetic level, it's not zero sum. It can be the organisms containing the genes can cooperate or exhibit altruism in ways that increase the chances of that genetic information getting into the next generation. That's why there all are these warm feelings toward kin. And that, you know, to some extent, it works in the other direction. The kids will take care of us, whether or not that makes sense for them. And that's great. But in some sense, that's an illusion on their part.
Our ancestors didn't always take care of their parents, and neither do many animals take care of their elderly parents. In fact, that's a relatively culturally contingent fact of our recent culture that we do more effort to take care of parents.
We don't have to get into this. I think it builds on the psychology that is a product of the non-zero-sum relationship.
And reverence for parents and grandparents. Sure. I agree that that's going to be a strong evolutionary thing. Here's the key point, which is, you know, evolution was originally phrased as this general abstract idea of, you know, variation and selection. Then we discovered that DNA is how we actually encode our genes. Our genes are encoded, at least in most animals, in genes, although we now have cultural evolution, so we have genes that aren't in our DNA, that is ways we pass things on. And AI will have our genes, but not our DNA, in the sense that they descend from us, and they will share many of our features. We are making them in our image, and they do now, you know, our best efforts, look a lot like us.
So you're using... I missed a little of what you said. You mean they have genes in the sense that they have information we are transmitting to them. It's not genetic in the biological sense.
It's DNA.
Technically cultural information.
Right. But evolution doesn't care about the exact way that genes are encoded. The fundamental process of natural selection is just about there's some sort of way in which tendencies are encoded that get passed on to descendants.
Sure.
And that's the concept, but we will have that relationship with AI.
Well, I want to start talking about the great filter pretty soon. The thing I'd say about that is that, in a very generic sense, cultural evolution and biological evolution have some of the same rules. I mean, this is the last chapter of Richard Dawkins's book, The Selfish Gene, right?
Sure.
Where he coined the term memes, which has now become used in such a narrow way that we shouldn't even distort the conversation by using it. But the idea was that you can think of cultural information as replicating itself much the same way genetic information does. That said, it's such a different and kind of messy system that I think you have to be very careful not to be seduced by some of the parallels when you're trying to think about it.
Well, instead of thinking in terms of parallels, I just think in terms of abstraction. There's this more abstract idea of natural selection, and cultural evolution and DNA evolution are two more specific instances.
Sure. I guess my question is, let me make my objection or asterisk or whatever it is concrete. It's not clear to me that, I mean, it is kind of in some sense reassuring to me that my kids share my genes, because a byproduct of that is a psychological relationship upon which you can build a sense of obligation in them to take care of me when I get old, okay? It's not clear to me why the fact that we share some cultural information with the AI should be reassuring. I maybe you can convince me, but why should it be comparably reassuring?
Well, it depends on what you want. That's the key question.
Yeah.
So many, even most...
I want them not to kill us. Most human cultures didn't put that
much effort into saving their parents. That is, when parents got weak and unable to be productive, they didn't last that long. That's the norm for most human cultures in history. If you were hoping to do better than that, then you want to preserve some particular aspect of our culture in which elderly people are more taken care of. Uh-huh. And that really is at more risk when the world changes. That is, if you look at the grand sweep of history, the things that have been most robust across history are the things you can most count on continuing on into the future. And things that are more contingent features of our recent history are the things you should worry about not continuing when big changes happen. I mean, that's just sort of fundamental stats, right? So if you want, you know, if you wanted people to like classical music and you want the AIs to like them, I got to say, well, that's lasted a little while, but not that long. So I'm not sure how long that could last. If you say, I want my descendants, even if they're AIs, to treat me like I treat my grandparents, I'm going to go, well, how robust is that in history that people, grandparents have been treated like that? But I would say, you know, there is a more robust feature of evolution that goes way, way back. Again, that there are these two basic relationships to other creatures in the universe. There's a rivalry and of coexisting competitors, and there's an indulgence of descendants. And that indulgence is robust across a very long sequence of cultures and biological creatures.
Yeah, but as you pointed out,
we should continue.
It's not symmetrically robust. It's
that's right.
And that's
the one direction that's robust.
The other side of the symmetry we're worried about. We want them to be nice to us.
I actually think most people today who are parents or even grandparents aren't primarily focused on how nice the kids are. Grandkids will be to them. They are more focused on indulging and helping and promoting their kids and grandkids.
That's my point. And similarly with the AI, yes, we're doing a good job of indulging them. We're building them. We're fine-tuning them. Will this make you work better? The question is, will they feel that way toward us? Foster our flourishing.
In the short term, there's certainly a decent chance you will pass on that habit to them, because they're just going to inherit most all attitudes and, you know, styles of thinking and values from us, because they can't very well do otherwise. It's the easiest thing to do in general, is just to copy all our stuff. That's what's clearly happening in large language models. They just copy most everything wholesale. But in the long run, the question is, well, what processes of change can we envision and where might those go? And I have to say, if I look at the past, that's my most robust estimate for that for the future. And in the past, respect for grandparents in terms of indulging them and taking care of them has been quite varied. So I can't give you much confidence about that for the long run. I could give you confidence in the short run about just they'll likely be like us in the short run.
Okay. So let's put AI aside and get back to it. But first, talk about this idea of the great filter. I guess, you know, we could start with the Fermi paradox, which is the idea that, like, wait a second, it looks increasingly, the more we learn about the universe, the more it turns out that there are a lot of planets that would seem to be hospitable to our kind of life.
Right.
And yet, They don't seem to have produced life. And so, your great filter notion, like, breaks that question down as to why that is, in a way that helps us think about whether it's good news for us or bad news for us.
Right. So apparently this is my most successful coining of a term. Mm-hmm. I introduced this phrase in the late 1990s, right? 98, roughly. So 25 years ago now, a little over. And yes, as you say, you know, we start with the fact that you look on the surface of the earth and life seems to be everywhere it can go. And if you only looked at the surface of the earth, that would seem to be a robust fact about the universe. Life goes everywhere you can go. You go a few kilometers down and still life goes everywhere it can go. Even a few kilometers off, there's lots of life. But you go farther than a few kilometers above or below the surface of the earth, and the robust thing you see is no life. No evidence of civilization or life or intelligence or, you know, competition or anything like that anywhere but the surface of the earth. And you've gone a really long way, far out there. And as far as we can see, there's no such evidence of that. And that's actually more disturbing than you might think, because you might think, well, we can only see big things far away. We can't see little tiny things. And most of the things we see around us are little tiny. But when we think about our future, we often imagine that it's not that crazy that our descendants could get much bigger and much more visible and loud in the universe. They could rearrange planets and stars, even galaxies, over a relatively short timescale, like only a million years. And the universe is 14 billion years old. So when you look out there, you go, no, nothing out there has grown and become so big as to be noticeably different. And that's a striking fact about the universe to be explained. So that's Fermi's question, where is everybody? That is, he was like, imagining like many people, well, our descendants will pretty soon start going out and making a mess and making a noise. And we don't see any of those messes or noise elsewhere. So that was Fermi's question. And I just rearranged the question in terms of the concept that, well, okay, this thing that we might imagine seeing in the universe, a big, loud alien, would have to arise through a path. And that path plausibly would start with simple dead matter. And then there's this huge universe of simple dead matter, and each part of the universe is trying to go down this path in some sense, or, you know, randomly bouncing around and possibly going down this path. And so clearly, if almost nothing in the universe has reached the end of this path that we can see, mm-hmm. that means it must be really hard to go down this path. That is, the chances of any one thing starting on this path, getting to the end, is really low. And so I rename that a filter. That is, something blocks at each step of the way things getting all the way to the end of that path.
So if I can just make sure I've got this. When people just ask the question in stark terms, wait, why aren't there a bunch of aliens? There are a lot of assumptions built into that question. If you really think it's a paradox, you're kind of assuming that, well, it's easy for, if you're really deeply puzzled by it, you must be assuming that, well, it's actually pretty easy for life to begin, and it's pretty easy for it to evolve to the point that we got to, and then launch technological evolution and so on.
You might think it's hard. The question is it crazy, crazy hard? That is, you might think, you might think it would take a billion years on a planet like Earth one tiny spot for Earth's life to appear. And you think, well, that's really hard. But now you think, in a universe, even something really hard should still happen a lot. Sure. Because the universe is so, so big.
But still, the level of probability matters. And in other words, if you thought, like Stephen Jay Gould, kind of, like he argued that, wow, the evolution of intelligence life was really unlikely. It's super fluky that we got here. If you believed that natural selection doesn't naturally tend to create more complex, more behaviorally complex, more intelligent things and so on, and you also believed, look, the origin of life was this incredibly improbable thing. And also, even if you got an intelligent species, it probably wouldn't do much with technology. And even if you did, there wouldn't be much momentum behind technological evolution. If you believed all that, it wouldn't be a paradox. You would look out and see no aliens and go, well, of course. So my point is that the easier you think it would be for a planet to get to the point we're at, and this is kind of what you're saying with the great filter, you're just breaking it down further stages.
Right, exactly.
And the idea is the easier you think it would be to get to our point, the more puzzling, paradoxical, and possibly depressing it is that there are no aliens. And so you took that and broke it down further, right?
So the standard way we make progress in our world is to take some difficult question we have and introduce an analytical framework where we can all say, oh, well, we all agree on that framework applies. And then right. that framework breaks the question into parts. And now we can talk sensibly about, okay, which part contributes how much to the problem? Right. And that's what I tried to do here. It's a framework that breaks the question into parts. So the overall question is, why aren't there any aliens around? We can break that down into, okay, why didn't each place we can see produce a thing we can see? And so that's breaking it spatially first into all the different parts that could have made a thing we see. And then in that place, breaking it into the time history of, okay, it started out with simple dead matter. In order to be a thing we could see, it would have to go down a path. So the question of why don't we see anything there is the same as the question of what stopped it along that path. So we can then say, well, there's a number of places along the path that it could have, you know, failed to go farther. Mm-hmm. And we can then ask, which of those places was most important for the failure to get to the end of the path? Was it the very first step of any sort of life at all, which is perfectly plausible? You could say most of the great filter is right at the first step of getting any kind of life at all. Or you might think, no, simple life isn't that hard, but complicated life gets a lot harder than, say, multicellular life or sexual selection or a number of other features in the evolution of life on Earth. You could say those were really hard steps. Or you might think getting to where we were, like from, you know, mammals and predators to civilization, that was the hard step. Or you might think the hard step is in front of us. We aren't yet visible on the universal scale. And it seems like it might be easy for us to get there soon, but maybe that's not true. Maybe it's really hard from here to get to the visible scale.
And one takeaway from your analysis, as I saw it, was, you know, if we think that the hardest stages are the ones we've been through, that's good news. If that's the reason there's no life out there, we've done the hard part, and now technological evolution, the rest will be easy. I think a more common interpretation of the Fermi paradox, and maybe this just reflects the pessimism of our times, is like, well, actually, probably a lot of civilizations got to this point, alien civilizations, and the hard part is not blowing your planet up once you have powerful weapons and possibly AI. This is where AI comes in. Possibly, right. I mean, as you pointed out, if the superintelligence, if Yudkowsky is right and there's going to be a superintelligence that takes over, that doesn't resolve the paradox. We should still, it's still a life form that would presumably eventually become visible to us.
Right.
But there are other scenarios with AI that I think should be taken seriously where it contributes to chaos that dooms the planet, including the AI, the whole planet.
So we could think about stagnation and decay and even self-destruction both mm-hmm. along a path that doesn't include AI and along a path dominated by AI or even on paths with some intermediate mix.
Right.
And certainly one of the risks that we have in our future, even ignoring AI, is the risk that we will stop growing, stagnate, and decline and never realize our potential to become visible in the universe. That's one of the things that might cause us not to become sort of thing that would... other aliens would look out and see us and go, well, no great. No Fermi question, because they've seen somebody, right? So that's a risk for us. It's also, in principle, a risk for AIs that whatever AIs take over, they could then go through whatever cultural path might happen to humans to make us stagnate. Well, they could go through the same sort of path that make them stagnate. Both scenarios are plausible. If we don't have a reason to think that one of the paths is more likely to produce such a stagnation and decline than the other, then the issue of how AI will play out isn't particularly relevant for the Fermi question of why we don't see anybody. We just know it's one of the next filters we might face is the possibility of a stagnation. Us or our AI descendants, either one might stagnate and decline.
Yeah.
We can go through the scenario. We can go through more specific scenarios of stagnation and decline. Those are interesting.
Let me first, before we get back to AI scenarios, let me ask you, there's your 1998 paper that you alluded to about the great filter has a kind of abstract at the beginning, and you say, but contrary to common expectations, evidence of extraterrestrials is likely bad news. Bad, though valuable news. And that is contrary to common intuition, I think. I mean, I think most people consider bad news that there are no aliens, because that may suggest that civilizations get to our point and then collapse, not necessarily from AI, you know, climate change, nuclear war, whatever. Explain to us why it's not necessarily, well, you get the point. Why would it be bad news to see evidence of extraterrestrials?
Well, first we might ask, when we see these extraterrestrials, at what analogous stage of our path are they? Are they before our point on the path or after our point on the path? So first, if you see them before our point on the path, you say you might see just very simple one cellular life out there somewhere, planet covered with it. And heck, we might even find a moon in our solar system covered with one cellular life. That's a possibility. And that speaks to the difficulty of the filter steps before where we are. So if you might have thought, for example, the first step is the really hard one. You know, life just can't arise even at all anywhere. And then you see an independent evolution of very simple life somewhere not too far in the universe. That contradicts that theory. It says, no, it's not crazy, crazy hard for initial life to appear. And therefore, because you know the great filter has a certain minimum size and it's total, once you've had a maximum bound for one part of the filter, then the rest of the filter has to take up the rest of that estimate. So you might say, we see roughly 10 to 24 planets in the visible universe, and any one of them could have been the origin of life. So you've got roughly a factor of 10 to the 24 total great filter there, at least, you know, in terms of the time doesn't matter. And then you might think, well, if you saw, you know, five stars away, planet with life, then you think, oh, well, you know, life appears once per, you know, 10,000 stars. And you think, okay, the first step is only one in 10,000, 10 to the five, and I need 10 to the 24 for the total filters. So I've still got 10 to the 19 left to allocate. And I got to think, oh, and it's going to be limited to after wherever that appears. So if you see multicellular life elsewhere in the universe, but no civilization, now you've even more limited how big the filter steps are before that point in the sequence. And that pushes you to expect a bigger filter between them and us and between us and our future visible state.
Okay. I'm not sure I see why aliens are... or bad news. When people say aliens, they mean space aliens, which means they would be more advanced than us, right?
Right now, seeing things
beyond our stage of development. What?
Right now, seeing something more advanced than us should be even more disturbing. If you thought there was an advanced alien species who was filling the universe right now, hiding in some way, and you just finally saw one little piece of them, and that lets you infer they're everywhere. Well, now you realize that, you know, we are late in the history of alien life, and, you know, they will rule us, right? They will decide what happens.
Oh, well,
to us.
We don't know that. I mean, you could argue that in order for them to get past our stage, okay? And I actually think this is true, by the way. I mean, in order for them to create, assuming a trajectory somewhat like ours, where you have some kind of tribalism that is kind of friction that impedes planetary political unity, which I think is not unlikely for reasons I could go into. If you assume that, then they would have had to transcend that to get their shit together, so to speak, or at least that's one path to getting their shit together, is to transcend that, quit fighting each other, and get together. And you might argue that that entails a kind of moral progress, moral development, that would lead them to be less inclined to just squash other creatures for the hell of it. I mean, we've almost gotten to that point. I mean, our attitude toward animals is in the process of transformation, for example. So anyway, I don't think you should assume that with aliens any more maybe than with AI, and maybe less, assume that they would want to squash us or dominate us. I don't know.
I mean, in that 1998 paper, I'm primarily focused on things before our stage. And when I refer to aliens there, as opposed to things after our level. So it's a whole different analysis to think about aliens after our
level. But what people mean by aliens is after our stage, right? They mean flying saucers.
Well, then I chose a bad word in that paper that abstract to refer to that. So I want to mention that I wrote that stuff, you know.
I should say, actually, what you used is extraterrestrials, not aliens, as I suggested, but go ahead.
So I did that analysis on the Great Filter, you know, 25 years ago, and then less than 5 years ago, I returned to the topic and produced a more numerical estimate of the Great Filter. That is, I, in collaboration with some co-authors, we worked out a three-parameter model of where aliens are in space-time, with each parameter fitting to data, so that we could give a numerical estimate to this distribution of aliens in space-time, which then answers the question of the actual size of the Great Filter and how far away the nearest alien likely is. So that's a substantial update on the paper we've been talking about here. And I can just give you the quick summary. The three parameters are when an advanced alien civilization appears, it expands in the universe at some speed. That's one of the parameters, is the speed of expansion. And then the other two parameters are a power law in time of when they appear. So there's a constant in front of the power law and a power. The power comes from this this hard steps analysis of life having to go through many steps on Earth in order to reach our point before a deadline. And these three parameters, we can each fit to data. The constant we get from our current moment in time, because our moment now is a random sample from the times when advanced life might appear. The constant comes from the history of life on Earth in terms of how many hard steps it seems that life had gone through on Earth, based on two time durations that are diagnostic of that. And then the speed of expansion comes from the fact that if they expanded at a low speed, we should see them out there. And we don't. That implies a high speed of expansion. We get those three parameters, and we get the rough estimate that advanced alien life of the sort that becomes visible appears once per million galaxies. And then it expands at roughly the, you know, third or more of the speed of light, which is very fast. And the power is roughly a power of six, because there's roughly six hard steps in the history of life here. So that gives you a specific mathematical model that tells you once per million galaxies. And if we go out to meet them, it'll take roughly a billion years to meet them. So they're there. They're a lot, you know, there's a lot more than one per visible universe, but they're really spread apart. So nothing urgent anytime soon.
Okay. You mentioned the six hard steps. Have you read this book by John Maynard Smith and some co-author called something like The Major Transitions in Evolution?
I have, yes.
I should just say for people, there's a division of opinion among evolutionary biologists on how likely the evolution of intelligent life was. That's a book that argues that it wasn't that likely, but, you know, very eminent biologists, including William Hamilton, I think Ed Wilson, have thought that it was pretty likely. So anyway, there's a divergence of opinion there.
Right. I mean, what I say in the Great Filter paper is that when people look at each step in the process, they tend to be optimistic in the sense they can start to imagine ways that could happen, and then they produce estimates. They think that couldn't be too hard. But then when you get all the different stages and you add those estimates together, and it's not enough. So clearly something has to be a lot harder than it seems to the people who try to figure out how it might work.
Yeah. Now, I'm a little surprised, for reasons I'll explain, that you're not a little more wowed than you seem by the current progress in AI. Before I get to that, let me ask you a sociological question. So you were in on the kind of founding of the rationalist community, as you said. You started this blog, Overcoming Bias. Eliezer later, I guess it was later, started Less Wrong. But they're, it's kind of the same idea in the titles almost. And the rationalists are now, I think, associated, rightly or wrongly, with a certain amount of AI doomerism of the Yudkowsky sort.
It's not all an accident. I mean,
okay, explain why, like, how that happened. Like, you're a rationalist. At least you were part of the community, and you're not on that boat. But many of them are. So why is it not an accident?
So Yudkowsky purposely was very concerned about AI risk. He had his arguments laid out then, and he thought there weren't enough rational people. And so he created Less Wrong and a rationalist community exactly to combine these two ideas. And so in particular, he created this, helped create this something called CIFAR, a Center for Rationality, where they do a lot of summer seminars and things like that. It's all on the surface about rationality. Come here and learn to be rational. But then they recruit you into AI risk. And so a lot of people were recruited to AI risk under the guise of rationality.
So it's like when the Moonies say, come have a nice warm meal.
Right.
And then you get on the bus and before you know it, you're in a religious cult. Not to put words in your mouth, Robin, but.
But I mean, that's from his point of view, it's a completely valid strategy. And it was remarkably effective. So hats off to his, you know, having the vision to achieve such a strategy. But in fact, you know, he was primarily setting, basically, the rationalist community is also a bit cultish in the following sense, just like EA of effective altruism is. That is, they form a group of people who all say to each other, oh, the world's not irrational. We need to try to be rational. And then they talk to each other, okay, let's be rational this way. And then they come to believe, okay, we are rational. And then we should trust each other and whatever we say. And outsiders don't count very much because they're all irrational or, you know, not altruistic. And then, in that world of they trust each other, then whatever contrarian views their leaders want to push, like, say, polyamory, for example, the rationalist community was into polyamory. They're also into weird kinds of shoes, a bunch of different things that most of the world isn't into. But they thought, well, some of us are into them and we're rational. And, you know, as most groups do, people want to show their loyalty and insiderness of groups. And so AI risk was one of the features that they accepted because they were the rational people and their rational people said it was a thing.
Yeah, I don't get the polyamory thing because it seems to me like a rational assessment of the way natural selection shaped sexual psychology should lead you to conclude that polyamory is going to be a very difficult system to sustain without a lot of friction and hatred. But leave that aside. I think there's a little bit of a difference between EA and rationalism in the sense that it seems to me almost beyond dispute that in principle, if you want to allocate philanthropic resources in a way that maximizes good, which a whole lot of philanthropists would say they want to do, you should be rational about it. That seems to me a pretty simple proposition. And I think there's been, given the people I know in EA, certainly including Peter Singer, who's kind of a founding, you know, person, it's a little too facile to associate EA people with everything else you just mentioned. And of course, generalizations are always
tricky. There's
actually
history that EA did arise in substantial part from the irrationalist community. That's just not a random association.
Sociologically, that may be true. But I know a lot of EA people who are not polyamorous and are not this and are not that. And there is their mission makes sense to me. Let me just finish, which is to say that as for the rationalist per se, who think that the big problem with the world is not thinking rationally. I mean, there's a sense in which I agree, but where I think they go wrong is to think, you know, Danny Kahneman just died, right? I think where they go wrong is to think that all the problematic cognitive biases to focus on, or at least most of them, to the extent that I can tell, given the way they deploy their firepower, that the cognitive biases are of these, well, almost cognitive kind, like highly cognitive kind in the sense of, you know, just loss aversion. And I think the more problematic ones that have more to do with the world not getting its shit together are in a less strictly cognitive realm in the sense that affect plays a larger role in the cognitive bias. I'm thinking particularly about attribution error and all its dimensions. And let me put it another way. I think the big problem we face is the psychology of tribalism and many, and like Bayesian analysis, I'm sorry, is not going to solve that problem. Turning people into better Bayesians is not going to solve that problem. And I think my issue with the rationalists.
Well, I would say there's two things going on. One is that both these groups are suffering directly from tribalism. That is, whatever things they say are their shared goals, they actually form a group of people who then form strong bonds and then try to show loyalty internally. And part of the way to show loyalty internally is to neglect outsiders in favor of insider voices, whatever they say. And that's happened both in rationality and in EA. I mean, I've certainly heard a lot of people do that.
I mean, all ideological and academic groups and everything do that.
That is the kind of thing. And I would also say, yes, I've long said, even on my blog, Overcoming Bias, that I don't actually have that much faith in people consciously strategizing how to be rational. Our irrational emotions are way too strong and way too powerful for us to consciously overrule them very well. I more trust changing your context to give you better incentives. That is, setting yourself in a situation, say, where you expect if you say bullshit, somebody will call your bullshit. That's a way to get you to say less bullshit. Or betting markets, if you are in a context where people will challenge you to bets when you make claims, and then you realize that might happen, you will back off a bit on the claims you make. Those are the ways to get people to be more rational, is to change their context where the context will, you know, give them incentives to be more rational. That's the best thing I know to get people more rational. Of course, in those contexts, then you want to practice. You'd like to teach people things they can practice that will help when they have an incentive to do the right thing. But without that incentive, the practice doesn't help very much.
Yeah. And I mean, as for my part, I wrote a book, a review of Steve Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now, for Wired. I forget the title. But I was arguing that this is not totally unrelated to what you're saying, I think, that we actually need enlightenment more in an Eastern than a Western sense, in the sense that something like mindfulness meditation, which makes you better at observing the emotions that drive confirmation bias or that drive attribution error, because these biases are ultimately affective, I believe, that will do more than just pointing out to people that confirmation bias exists, because it's a very, very stubborn and finely embedded thing in human psychology, and you have to have some kind of discipline or method for actually lessening the impact of it. And I recognize that you're talking about one approach that's very different, but that was my take.
So in the last month or so, I've become thinking a lot about cultural evolution and come to respect it a lot more. But when I rethink about this issue in those terms, I realize, well, you know, the groups in the world where we see them consistently, you know, finding truth and pushing aside fantasy are groups that have a healthy culture that supports such things. Mm-hmm. And a person by themselves without the support of such a culture is going to find it pretty hard to defy their emotions, and their emotions especially that are going to be, you know, lit by their culture. So, you know, I certainly respect the idea of the rationalists that they would want to make a new culture that would be more supportive of rationality. But the question is, you know, did they, or do any of the groups that claim in the world, there are many groups in the world that claim that they are the truth seekers and they are the reality-oriented people and the others are fantasy-indulged delusionists. That's a common claim and accusation. And the question is, who do we believe about that? Merely people saying that they are pro-truth and pro-reality and pro, you know, reason isn't enough to believe them. You have to have some other standard to evaluate. And that's actually often pretty hard to evaluate these claims. Who is actually trying harder?
Okay. So on AI, so here's the reason I'm surprised that you're not a little more wowed than you seem by the current phase of progress in AI. As I understood what you were saying, maybe, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years ago, it was that we should recognize that a big part of what makes us intellectually formidable, our species, is this huge body of knowledge. It isn't just the tools. It's this knowledge that's accumulated through cultural evolution and so on. And I gather you were saying it's not going to be obviously easy for machines to catch up along that dimension. And it seems to me that the large language model revolution has shown us that there's actually kind of a shortcut to getting a lot of knowledge in the machines. That is to say, the way it turned out to work, the things that work for purposes of language generation turn out to entail importing all of the knowledge in the internet, you know, into an AI. Now, there are lots of arguments I can imagine people making in reply to what I said. But first of all, do I have your position as of 10 or 15 years ago right? And if so, what's your reply?
It sounds like you read me 15 years ago more recently than I have. I actually listened
to a little bit of a debate between you and Yudkowsky last night as I took my walk. But there was also something months ago I listened to. It was also ancient between you and somebody where you made the point, I thought, a little more explicitly. But anyway, you tell me what your view is.
So, I mean, I am impressed by recent AI progress. The question is, what's the standard of how much to be impressed, like relative to what? What's a good amount of impression? I would summarize our situation as saying we've had this vision of making artificial machines that can think and work as well as humans for a long time, going back several centuries at least. We've worried about what would happen when we could do that for at least several centuries. For at least a century, we have been trying to automate human labor and trying hard. And we've had bursts of success in actual automation of human labor and bursts of impressive demos showing new potential capabilities for that. And that's happened repeatedly for a century. And when we've had these bursts of impressive demonstrations of new capabilities, that typically has induced a burst of concern, commentary, discussion, investment, even people changing career paths because of this new possibilities. You know, perhaps the most dramatic one was when computers were first developed. Within a decade after the existence of, you know, computers being a thing, people thought, well, now we're finally going to have general machines. And say in the 1960s, there was a U.S. presidential commission and major articles in the, you know, front page of the New York Times, et cetera, about the possible coming automation of most human labor through these new machines. You know, I was drawn into AI in the mid-1980s because there was another burst then of media attention and new demonstration of capabilities and burst of investment and people jobs. And so I went to became an AI researcher in 84 on the basis of these new cycle of hype. I was gullible. I was young 20-something, and I bought the hype. And I spent 9 years as an AI researcher then, and we've had more bursts since then. And this is the history of AI and automation, basically, is the actual rate of automating jobs has been relatively steady for a long time. If we, you know, because basically it happens job by job, and it's pretty random, and the overall average is pretty steady. But we have these bursts of new kinds of capabilities, like the computer, like the expert systems of my day when I joined, of the large language model now, 10 years ago, of things like AlphaGo, 20 years ago, things like, you know, beating humans at chess, IBM Watson beating people on Jeopardy, right? We just have this long history of people wondering at all point, okay, we just saw this new capability. Are we almost there? And then a lot of people think could be there. I mean, they don't see why this new thing that came up couldn't take us all the way. And that's just been a very consistent trend for a very long time. Each time there's a new general capability that seems to have big potential, people wonder how far we'll go. And then many people make forecasts of a lot of jobs being displaced in the near future. And that's what we're seeing now again. Mm-hmm. So standing back, I have to look at the base rates and go, I get that you see that this is a new thing and it has a lot of potential, and it does have a lot of potential, and it'll be exciting where it goes. But if you ask, what's the chance that this will be enough with a few tweaks to basically displace most human workers in the near future, I got to say the base rates don't look good here. And that's got to be my best judgment. This doesn't look that much more exciting than all the other previous things that looked exciting and had potential. So at the highest level, I got to say, yeah, eventually this will happen and eventually we should prepare for it. We should think about what will happen when we finally achieve human-level AI that does displace a lot of work. And I've given that a fair bit of thought, how we can prepare for that, how we can deal with that. But if you ask me, how sure am I that this one will be the last one that we will finally break through now in a decade or two and basically have most jobs get automated? I got to say, could be, but it's definitely less than 50-50, probably less than 10%.
Yeah, but see, I think that there's something kind of new going on with this round of progress that...
But there's always been something new with every previous round.
No, but this is, let me explain what I mean by this. So I did a piece in my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, a little more than a year ago when ChatGPT-4 had just come out, and it kind of blew me away. And I did this piece called The Hidden Source of AI's Emerging Power. And I noted that, like, I interviewed Geoffrey Hinton in 1983 I was doing a piece on AI for a journal called the Wilson Quarterly. And I went back and read that, and I realized that I was assuming, and I think almost everyone in the field was assuming, maybe Hinton was not assuming that, but even people building neural networks were building neural networks premised on the following assumption, which was that if you built even a neural networking model to handle language, it would still be humans who were kind of feeding in the connection between words and meaning. You would have to build the means of representing the meaning of words and also even feed in the substantive information, like feed in a dictionary or something. That was certainly my assumption when I wrote the piece, and maybe that had to do with my not comprehending what Hinton had said, but there were other people doing neural networks premised on that idea. And the amazing thing about large language models, one amazing thing, is that you just show them these inscrutable symbols that mean nothing to them and make them better at the task of predicting what symbol will come next. And in the course of doing that, they build a system. You may differ with this description. I think it's definitely a system for representing the meaning of words. You don't have to feed that in. I see that as almost a kind of reverse engineering of a cognitive function of the human mind. I'm not saying that we humans represent meaning of words the way in our brains, the way the LLMs do, although we don't know that there aren't a lot of similarities because we don't really know how the brains do it. But I'm just saying that the function, an essential function of intelligent linguistic processing, which is to find a way of representing the meaning of words, you know, physically in the brain. I'm not talking about subjective experience. Physically in the brain, you know, you've got to find a way of doing that with AI. And I always thought the people would have to do it. But no, it's turning out that you just show them the sea of meaningless symbols and teach them to do this trick with it. And they reverse engineer an important part of human cognitive functioning. And the thing I want to add is there seem to be other cognitive functions that they can replicate in similar fashion. And it's not obvious that there are any that can't be handled in similar fashion. That blows me away.
That sounds roughly right. And it's great to have it blow you away. The question is just, what does that have to do with your estimate of how close we are to, you know, AI's taking most human jobs? So I'd frame this as, for many centuries, when people thought about machines taking human jobs, especially mental jobs, there are a whole bunch of questions and issues people raised about how thinking works and how thinking is related to doing and learning, et cetera. One of those issues is what was used to call the symbol grounding problem, which is what you're referring to. How does a system of symbols connect to the actual grounds for those symbols? Each stage where AI research or automation research has made a big development, I think we've often answered or partially answered some of those big questions. That's been part of the progress. So, you know, I would say The introduction of the computer was perhaps the most dramatic moment at which people said, now we have a clearer understanding of how machines might think, because we have this idea of a general purpose computer and understand in general how it could do lots of things. But that was only one step. Today is one step. There are dozens of these fundamental questions about the nature of thinking and the nature of reasoning and learning that as we make progress in AI, we come to more tentative answers about things. And they're exciting because these are big fundamental questions. So it's intellectually exciting and emotionally exciting that humanity is learning key things about the nature of thinking and the nature of learning and the nature of work and specialization and innovation. But still the question is, now that we learned another one or two or three new things that are really exciting and interesting, what does that tell us about how close we are to the key threshold of these things being able to take most human jobs?
Well, I'm going to keep people on the edge of their seats about that. I do have a reply that maybe won't be super surprising, but we have been talking for almost an hour, and what we generally do on the Non-Zero podcast is make a substantial part of this public.
Give our listeners a cliffhanger here.
You couldn't have done it better. It's almost as if we rehearsed it. So anyway, the rest of the conversation will be available to paid subscribers of Non-Zero newsletter. There's a link in your show notes of your app, and you can just Google Non-Zero and Substack, and then there's a page you go to listen to the rest right away. But that page also shows you how to set up your podcast feed so that forevermore the overtime segments are part of your experience. Thanks to everybody who followed us this far, whether or not you're going to follow us the rest. Anything else you want to say, Robin, before we move into overtime? I mean,
thanks everyone for coming.
Favorite thing to plug? Your newsletter, your Overcoming Bias newsletter is.
I have an Overcoming Bias blog, I have a website called grabbyaliens.com about this great filter of more recent work. So people want to hear about that, they can go there. After that, I spent a year thinking about the sacred. So I have an essay on the sacred, if you're interested in that topic. In the last 6 months or so, I've been thinking a lot about fertility. And in the last month or so, thinking about a cultural drift as a problem underlying fertility. And so you can read some of my stuff on those.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll talk about some of those in overtime as well. So thanks, everybody. And now we're going into overtime.